Thank you for joining us for June 7th Wednesday reading of the June 2023 edition of Model Railroad Magazine. My name is Kevin Harvey. Today we'll be reading the following main articles: Seaboard Central by Tim Garland, and we'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Operations and Motive Power take precedence on this HO scale layout. The Seaboard Central is a modern HO scale regional railroad set in the southeastern United States between Birmingham, Alabama, and Savannah, Georgia, during the spring of 2015. The following is the story of my lifelong dream and passion of creating my own railroad in miniature. This is the story of the Seaboard Central Railroad. An early start. Like many hobbyists, I started collecting model trains along with anything else train-related at an early age. Initially, I had planned on modeling the Clinchfield Railroad after being fascinated by this unique coal hauling line located in the Appalachian Mountains. However, what I didn't realize was that I liked most about it was its size. The Clinchfield was similar in size to the Denver and Rio Grande Western, or the Florida East Coast, the FEC, two railroads that were also some of my favorites. They weren't large compared to the other Class 1 railroads, but still employed modern horsepower like their larger counterparts. Then during the mid-1980s, Model Railroad Magazine started publishing articles by Eric Broman about his Utah belt, the UB. Like Alan McClellan's Virginia and Ohio, the Utah belt had the same charm as the Clinchfield and the Rio Grande, but was one of the most realistic freelance model railroads I'd ever seen. I was completely captivated by the Utah belt, and before I knew it, the seed for creating the Seaboard Central had been firmly planted. So I went on trying to find out as much as I could about Eric Broman's creation by accumulating every article that had been written about his amazing model railroad. Now, instead of the Clinchfield, my new dream was to have a freelance model railroad similar to the UB. From this point, I started looking for a logical place for my railroad to exist. My thought was that in order for it to be conceivable, it would need to operate over existing secondary track that a Class 1 railroad would most likely sell or lease. It didn't take long before I started to formulate a plan by connecting lightly used trackage formerly owned by the Seaboard Coastline, the SCL, and others from the Central of Georgia, the CG. Then in December of 1985 and January of 1986, Model Railroader published a couple of articles on a project layout called the Seaboard Central. A light went on in my head. Here was the perfect name for my railroad, a railroad that existed by utilizing former SCL and CG tracks. Thus, the Seaboard Central was born. The concept. The Seaboard Central, for all intent purposes, is considered a modern-day regional railroad similar in size to the FEC. It links Birmingham, Alabama to Savannah, Georgia, and the ports, with a few branch lines in between. The SC's history begins by taking over operation of the Cedartown branch from the CSX on January 1, 1990, as a Class 3 shortline railroad. The Cedartown branch runs between its namesake and Cartersville, Georgia, and began operations with a former Conrail GP38 and an ex-Seaboard system GP16. Both units were painted scarlet and dark gray with yellow Seaboard Central lettering on their sides. In 2000, SC took over trackage from Cedartown to Sonora, Georgia, under a lease agreement with Norfolk Southern, NS. Later in 2004, the SC managed to acquire the trackage from Cedartown, Georgia, to Birmingham, Alabama, from CSX. This included a branch from Willington to Gunnersville, Alabama. 2004, the SC changed its paint scheme from scarlet and gray to dark blue with white lettering, first showing up on three former Southern Pacific SD40T-2s. Through the years, the railroad continued to grow, acquiring the former CG Forest Park to Macon, Georgia line from NS in 2008, and also by rebuilding sections of abandoned track in order to connect the properties. by 2012 after the acquisition of the Georgia Central's former SCL Main between Macon and Savannah, Georgia, the Seaboard Central had grown to a Class II carrier and had amassed a moderately sized fleet of second-generation EMDs consisting mostly GP38-2, GP40-2, and SD40-2 units. Many of the diesels retained their original owner's paint schemes and were simply patched over to get them into service quicker. Track plan. When it comes to operating our layouts, model railroaders often fall into two different categories. Those who enjoy the railfan perspective and those who enjoy switching and operations. I personally enjoy both. However, I enjoy switching the most when it comes to operations. I especially enjoy yard switching and can spend hours sorting out cars in my yard. For me, I'll take the yard job over everything else. The current version of the Seaboard Central is an around-the-wall sectional layout with a center peninsula located in a 19-foot 9-inch by 22-foot 9-inch room in my basement. A 12-foot 9-inch long 4-track staging yard resides in an adjoining room representing both Gadsden, Alabama and Macon, Georgia. Originally, I had planned on building a double-deck layout similar to Pell, Solberg's, Danville and Donner River. I built the lower level 40 inches off the floor. My intention was to practice all my techniques on the lower level, then use my newly gained skills to finish the upper level. However, after enjoying the current level of operations on the lower level, I realized that the upper level wasn't necessary. By early 2019, I'd removed all the upper level brackets and installed new backdrops. The layout includes a locomotive servicing area, car shop on one wall, and a moderate-sized yard on the other. A few small industries are also located here and there. Running trains. Operations on the layout include two NS trackage right trains that offer the chance to run big, modern diesel power. These trains run from staging to staging and don't perform work en route. The other two mainline trains are SC441, SC442. These trains operate between Gadsden, Alabama and Macon, Georgia, the staging, and stop at Griffin to make set outs and pickups. Two Griffin-based locals, or what the SC calls road switchers, round out the trains on the layout. Train G50 operates Monday through Friday and comes on duty at 6 a.m. Train G51 operates Sunday through Thursday and comes on duty at 4 p.m. Since traffic over the railroad isn't heavy, it's not signaled, but instead operates under track warrant control, TWC. I always intended for the SC to be a laid-back and slow-paced railroad. It offers just enough of a challenge to keep things interesting, but doesn't have the high pressure of a signaled centralized traffic control, CTC system, where things can seem rushed. Due to speed restrictions and Federal Railroad Administration designated status, maximum speed on the main line is 25 miles per hour, and all other trackage is limited to 10 miles per hour. Curves and grades often restrict trains to 15 miles per hour. Slowing the movements down not only lengthens the otherwise short run, but also makes the models look more realistic operating around tight curves. A model railroad can have incredible scenery and outstanding models. However, the realism can be completely destroyed by operating models too fast in the curves or slamming into cars, making hard couplings. As a professional, when I see unrealistic operations such as that on a model railroad, it makes me cringe. Locomotive roster. A couple of things were important when developing the SC locomotive roster. First, the roster had to reflect current practices of the Class II regional carriers during the time period being modeled. Second, as a professional locomotive engineer, they had to meet my approval. In my book, not all locomotives are created equal, especially after you run them for a living. The SC prefers second-generation EMD locomotives, not only for their reliability and performance, but also the ample number of parts that are readily available. This includes models such as SW1500, MP15, GP15-1, GP38, GP38-2, GP40-2, SD40-2, and SD40T-2. The latest locomotives to arrive on property in first and second quarter of 2015 were 5 EMD SD32 ECO units, assembled by Juanita Locomotive Works, and 4 ES44T4 units built by General Electric at its Fort Worth, Texas facility. These 9 locomotives are the first to wear the new dark blue and black scheme, a nod to the SCL and CG. With their arrival, this enabled the SC to return 6 EMD GP40X diesels, 2 cabless GP60Bs, and 4 SD50s off lease. The models in my fleet are from Athearn, Atlas, Intermountain, Cato, MTH, and Scaletrains. All locomotives are equipped with ESU lock sound decoders and capacitors and light-emitting diode lighting. The layout. Through the years, after much trial and error, a few standards have developed regarding the layout. The layout is powered by NCE DCC, which replaced an earlier lens system. NCE is preferred for ease of use and the ability to support advanced consisting. Along with the NCE system is a new controller from Iowa Scaled Engineering called the Protothrottle. This device is just like having a miniature control stand in the palm of your hand. It allows me to operate my models similar to the prototype, and it works well with NCE systems. It'll also work with most DCC systems. I rarely use my other throttles now because the Protothrottle makes operating trains so much more fun and realistic. The track is all Microengineering Code 83. I prefer Microengineering due to its realistic appearance. The minimum radius on the layout is 24 inches. From my experience, anything tighter than 24 can cause a derailment, and with some of the modern equipment that I have operating on the layout. Backdrops on the layout are all commercial photo prints from trackside scenery. When I updated the layout, I ended up installing these photo backdrops on large styrene sheets. Then I used double-sided tape to mount the styrene sheets to the wall. This way, all the backdrops can be preserved and used again on future versions of the SC. The layout is mostly made up of 24-inch wide sections. Many are 7 to 8 feet long. The height of the railhead is 40 inches from the floor. A future version would be between 48 to 54, which is more reasonable height for a single level layout. Most of the rolling stock on the layout is equipped with Exact Rail Code 88 metal wheels and KD semi-scale couplers. I really appreciate the more realistic look of the narrow wheels, semi-scale couplers. To me, it's the same effect as the change from Code 100 to the more realistic Microengineering Code 83 FlexTrack. I've had no issues with the narrow Code 88 Exact Rail wheels operating over my Microengineering track. To make the rolling stock even more realistic, an effort is being made to equip all cars with uncoupling levers and magnetic air hoses. Also, the cars are being weighted to improve performance on an as-needed basis. I aim to weather everything on the layout. However, my recommendation for any model railroader is to start by weathering the track and the wheel sets first. Rail and wheels tend to be a raw umber color, but can vary depending on usage and age. Cross ties range from gray to dark brown, and rail car trucks can be anywhere from flat black to raw umber, depending on how long the car has been in service. Just weathering these two items will completely transform a layout into a great-looking model railroad. This version of the SC has been a great learning experience and a joy to operate. Along the way, mistakes have been made, but in the end, they have made me a better modeler. The satisfaction that I have reached from this layout and watching it develop into what it is today drives me to continue to learn and grow in the hobby. Meet Tim Garland. Tim Garland, A Norfolk Southern locomotive engineer has been passionate about trains since childhood. When he is not working on the prototype, he can be found moving freight on the Seaboard Central. Here's a little on Trains of Thought by Tony Coaster. Beginning with the end in mind, it's always a good idea to listen to those who have more experience than we do. That means we should be doing a lot of listening. One of my favorite gurus is layout designer, builder, and good friend Lance Mendheim. John Monas of Kansas City recently reminded several of us on a chat group of one of Lance's pearls of wisdom. It's a good idea to begin track planning with the end in mind. For many, that means thinking about what an operating session will look like. Lance always asks clients of his layout building business how they will operate. How often? By themselves or in formal sessions? How long will the session last? The most common answer is that people will run trains fairly regularly, by themselves, for about 30 minutes. If a session is about a half hour, it doesn't take much track to keep busy. Less track means more space for a better appearance. We're looking to relocate to the sunny southeast, no basement territory, John commented. So my next layout may be around the walls, bedroom, shelf layout. This actually works for me, as I find maybe at most an hour of operation is just fine. I thought my next layout would be the Granger type, elevator, fuel dealer, coal, lumber, etc. Since I'd have space for only one town, this might be somewhat limiting. I've given a lot of thought to a small layout based around just a freight house and team track, John continued. Eric Hansman has made several excellent posts on his blog regarding this type of operation. This also works for my newfound interest in building freight cars, specifically a lot of 40-foot box cars. John concluded by noting that I've always liked the Seaboard airline, although I can't explain why exactly. My only connection to the area is throwing the Army stuff out of the back end of a C-130 at Fort Bragg. The Seaboard came in from four directions, plus connections with maybe three other railroads. I see Fiddle Yard with sorting tracks on one end of the shelf, freight house on the other. I'm still working on how many sorts at the freight house per day. This is also close to where we want to move, somewhere between Savannah and Charleston. Clark Probst, who has written about his HO railroads and model railroad planning builds on Lance's suggestion. Imagine what the entire layout will look like when finished, so you will have space for all the auxiliary structures and know how the scenery will set the scene. We disregard such sage advice at our own peril. Building a model railroad of any scope takes time and money, so it pays to have the odds stacked in our favor. We venture too far out into the swamp. It's not that building model railroad is difficult, that we become discouraged and decide that it is. Having a plan on paper or a computer screen is not absolutely necessary for success. Some of us have built rather complex model railroads having never drawn a track plan. Not having a clue as to your destination as you begin erecting benchwork is almost certain to erect needless barriers to success. A hobby is something we do to escape the trials and tribulations of the rest of our lives. It should be enjoyable and rewarding. It should not impose undue burdens on our already complex daily routines. Conversely, scale model railroading is a rather complex endeavor. You can simplify it to a degree by using snap-together track, ready-built structures, and ready-to-run rolling stock and locomotives. Digital command control has simplified much of our wiring while allowing multiple trains to be controlled by more than one operator. Beyond that, however, the tasks start to pile up. Taken one at a time, they're not erroneous. But when viewed as a whole, benchwork, track laying, wiring, backdrops, scenery, structures, weathering rolling stock and locomotives, lighting, perhaps adding working signals, they may look overwhelming. So we go back to Lance's advice. Move ahead methodically with the end in mind. Don't overdo it. It's a hobby. So be sure to take time to enjoy the process. From the Editor by Eric White, Why I Enjoy Model Railroad Operations. As I write this, I'm a week past returning from a weekend of model railroad operations in the San Francisco Bay Area. I had the distinct pleasure of operating on Jack Burgess's famous Yosemite Valley Railroad, along with other layouts that may someday share his layout's fame. Seeing this beautifully designed and built layout was a highlight of the trip. But there are other aspects that draw me back to operating sessions repeatedly. One of my favorite parts is the problem solving, whether it's figuring out how to switch an industry or a yard, or calculating the timing to get to a siding before another train is due to pass. There can be a lot of thinking going on in an operating session. My favorite jobs combine a bit of main line running with some switching, so a turn or local is my first choice. I also enjoy the social aspects of the events. After doing this for several years, I've come to look forward to seeing the people I've had fun operating with in the past. Getting to see how people built their model railroads is another highlight. How did he fit this much railroad into his basement? How did he build his bench work? It's another aspect of problem solving. Finally, it gives me an insight into how prototype railroads work by simulating the work they do. What's the purpose of signals, track warrants, timetables, and train orders? It's how the railroad gets trains safely and efficiently to their destinations on a layout it's not unlikely to run into life or death situations, but no one wants to spend a Saturday stuck in a siding. I know operating isn't for everyone, but if you're curious, opsig.org is a good place to learn and meet like-minded people. Check it out. Question. I watch videos of model railroads on YouTube. On a video of a Boston and Maine layout, I saw a strange steamer. An A210-2 had a long tender, and on the rear truck of the tender, the wheels had counterweights and were ganged together with a connecting rod. Why? Answer. What you're seeing under that tender is a booster engine, which some manufacturers called an auxiliary locomotive. It's a small two-cylinder steam engine, either under the tender or on the engine's trailing truck, that runs off steam from the main boiler. Its purpose is to help start and maintain slow speed on heavy trains. A steam locomotive can be designed either to run well at high speed or produce a lot of traction at a lower speed, depending on the size of the drivers. Since the pistons and drive rods of a steam locomotive are directly connected to the drive wheels, there's no way for a steam locomotive to change gears, like an automobile can, to switch between speed and high power. A high-speed, generally passenger, locomotive doesn't perform well when traction is needed. Also, a steam engine can't just turn down its fire when less steam is needed. Instead, the excess steam is vented away, so at lower speeds, the locomotive is wasting a lot of steam power. Enter the booster engine, which turns that wasted steam into additional low-speed traction. Booster engines were an average rated at about 300 horsepower at a speed of 10 to 30 miles per hour. The engineer would use the booster to get the train started, then cut out the booster when it got up to a speed that the main engine could handle more efficiently. Well, that's all the time we have for this week, folks. Join us again next time when we'll talk about animating a coal mine. So until then, thank you for joining us for Model Railroading Magazine. My name is Kevin Harvey. Have a great day, and keep railroading.